weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Big thanks to the gang for driving us through the afternoon. It's Wednesday, the October 30th, and you're listening to Game On. Well, as the dust settles on Ireland's victory over Georgia and their progression to the playoff final against Wales, we'll review all the action with Paul Corrie, Anthony Pyne and Maeve De Burka. Plus, Ruud van Nistelrooy will get a taste of managing Manchester United in the Carabao Cup before Ruben Amorim takes the reins. And of course, we'll bring you the latest from the world of Gaelic games with updates and insights on all the big news from Damien Lawler. As always, if you want to have your say, you can text us on 51552, WhatsApp us on 087-187-9200, or we're on X at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. I'm delighted to say that Paul Corrie and Anthony Pyne are with me in studio. We also have Maeve De Burka on the line as well. We're just going to pick the bones over Ireland's performance against Georgia. Maybe actually there are two performances against Georgia in the first round of the playoff. Maeve De Burka joins us now. Maeve, I guess in one way it's done, they've won, it's job done, but at the same time we're looking for things to build on now heading into these games against Wales. What do you think they are?
Yeah, I think I suppose the crowd last night would have maybe liked to have seen more goals. Definitely, you know, we started well with Julianne's goal, obviously after only 3 minutes, but then after that I think everyone is hoping for a lot more. But I think it's difficult when we're playing against such a low block that I don't think Wales are going to, you know, have that same they won't be as negative, I suppose, in how they play. They're going to push on a bit, so I think it'll be a completely different game against Wales going forward. But at least we've got a few goals over the last couple of games anyway. 9 goals isn't too bad.
Do you think, Anthony, that we have settled on a team? Because there was a few positions up for grabs. One of them was the 6. Jessie Stapleton went in there for a while, then she went back to centre back. Tyler Tolan played there on Friday but was on yellow, so she didn't start. What do you think?
I don't think Eileen Gleeson has settled on a team. I think she settled on a formation and a way of setting up, which would be a 3-5-2 or some sort of variation of that. I mean, looking back on the last time Ireland played Wales, who they'll face in this playoff final back in February, she tried a sort of 4-2-3-1 setup that night that just didn't work. It was a mess, really. And Ireland were very well beaten that night. But, you know, in the 6 European Championship qualifiers since then, and then in the 2 legs of the playoff semi-final, they've settled into a 3-5-2 by and large. So there is a lot of competition within that squad. There may be some variations, particularly within that midfield 5. There'll be a big question mark around where exactly Katie McKay plays. She obviously played more centrally in the games against Georgia. She might be used in that way against the Welsh. But like, and up front as well, because we saw Julianne Russell and Kira Caruso paired for the first time together over the first two games. That could be something she's considering. So I think there's question marks around the actual personnel, but I would be fairly confident that it would be a 3-5-2 setup against Wales.
I'm going to throw a curveball at you, Maeve De Burka. Tara Hanlon was in around the squad for familiarisation. We know she's a left full back. She's not back on the pitch yet, but is expected to be on the pitch in the next couple of weeks. Given that we're trying to find a way to get Katie higher off the pitch, does her return, if it happens, maybe alter where Katie might play?
Yeah, I think so. I think there is she's a quality player. Obviously she's at Man City now and still really young, only 19, so I think maybe they're looking at more of the future as well, just to get her in and around, like I said, it's familiarisation with the squad. But yeah, it definitely does allow us an option. But I mean, you can have Izzy Atkinson there as well, mm-hmm. at the moment, and she's definitely the option. They have used her in the past in a pre-World Cup friendly. I think Katie had gone off in Tala, so it was sometimes that she's an option too, and obviously Julianne too. But I think Julianne would be an option there against the weaker teams where we see a lot more attacking. But Tara is definitely a player with huge potential. I think she's going to be a big player going forward for Ireland.
Yeah, I'm so excited to see her when she does get back onto the pitch and get back playing, because as you said, she is the future, and you've Jessie there as well and Abby Larkin and all these young players coming through. Anthony, you mentioned Julianne Russell there. She did play more of a wide role because we were attacking. I was kind of excited to see how the combination with herself and Kira Caruso would go. Probably didn't get to see enough of it. What kind of a role do you think they're both going to have in the Wales game?
Yeah, I mean, that's true, Maria. She changed it because basically there was no space in behind Georgia in Tbilisi, so Katie McCabe was brought into the centre to try and make things happen and be a little bit more creative and pick holes within that really deep, compact Georgian defence. So Julianne pulled out wide to the left. I think if she does play off Ciara Caruso, you would think that Wales, particularly in Cardiff, will come on to Ireland more than what we saw Georgia do. They just didn't come out with that shape. Even when they were 9-0 down on aggregate, they barely came out of their own box. So, you know, that in turn would leave space in behind, which Julianne is really good at exploiting. She did it fantastically well against France at Parc Eiquiv. And Ciara Caruso is a good link player. She's a good target player. She can hold the ball up. She can bring midfielders into play. So I would think that is a combination on paper that could work really well. But it was, as I said, I'm not really sure, I'm not really sure what way she goes. She does have options, Eileen. I mean, she's built up depth in that squad over the last year, so there's a few different ways she could approach it, but I think that's something that could work well, particularly away from home.
Paul, what were your thoughts on the Ireland performances?
Listen, I think the squad as a whole has grown an immense amount, Marie, over the last couple of years. I think it's very hard to gauge too much from the two games that we've seen over the last week against Georgia, just because the opposition was so poor. I think Ireland is constantly learning about the players and probably will learn a huge amount, particularly in that European qualifying groups phase where you're kind of playing against the elite, and it's probably from those games that she'll probably leverage her experience of which team to pick. And I think irrespective of what team you go with, it's so important that when you play away from home in that first leg that you bring something home. And maybe that means that she sets up a little more defensively and maybe uses more of a defensive minded players than going all gung ho. I mean, you're talking there about Julianne Russell playing up alongside Caruso and being expansive and attacking. I'm not really sure that'll be at the forefront of Eileen's thought process after or during the first game. I think a lot of it will be about containing Wales and making sure that we have a result whereby we're either level or just slightly ahead of Wales coming into the home leg. And I think if they are level playing Wales at home, I think they'll fancy themselves to go through from a, you know, a once-off 90-minute match. So very hard to take too much from those Georgian games just because of the difference in level between ourselves and themselves. But I think there'll be a huge amount of knowledge that Eileen will have been able to suck up over the group stage campaign in particular, that she'll be thinking about what way and what formation and what personnel she'll utilise for that Wales game.
And Maeve, when you think about this Wales game coming down the track and the fact that they came through a very difficult test against Slovakia, would you prefer to be in Wales' situation having came through that?
I still think we go into it as favourites, but probably only slightly favourites too at the same time. I mean, yeah, I think a win like that, such a big win in extra time, can only galvanise a squad. And I think when you look at it on paper, we're only five ranking places ahead of Wales, so it's definitely going to be a tough game. And, you know, we did, like Anthony referred to, the game in February in Tala was probably one of our worst performances under Eileen. You know, but Jess Fishlock for Wales, I thought, was immense that night, and she's still going strong. At 37, she's still flying it. She played all the game last night. She scored again last night. She scored the last time we played them in February. So I think we're going to be really up against it. I don't think it's going to be an easy game at all, or easy double-legged game, but I would have preferred to have been facing Slovakia. But still, I think we have enough, like the lad said, like there's so much depth now in the squad and kind of just options there for Eileen, and even options off the bench as well. Such attacking players that can change a game if and when they're needed.
Anthony, do we have enough options around the middle? Because the middle is where we tend to chop and change quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, bearing in mind that we were missing Megan Connolly and Rusha Littlejohn for the Georgia games. Lucy Quinn didn't even get into the squad. She's made a really strong start to the season at Birmingham City, but she didn't even make the panel. So I think there's options there. What Ireland have in the middle of the park, Marie, is a lot of players who are cut from a similar cloth. A lot of players who can do similar jobs. Even someone like Jesse Stapleton, who is very capable of sitting back into centre half if you needed her. But she can also play as a six. Tyler Toland, Rusha, who might be back by the end of November, December for the playoff final game. So there's a lot of players who can do similar things. I think what we're lacking is a player like Jessu, who unfortunately is injured. That type of technically good footballer who's really good in tight spaces. I think she was missed against Georgia. I know we won 9-0 on aggregate, but I just think there was times where we toiled. There was large portions of the tie where we toiled. We couldn't figure them out. We started to look quite predictable. She just has that intelligence and technical capability to pick a lock. But look, as Maeve and Paul have alluded to, this is going to be really tight. And I think in terms of going to Cardiff and getting some sort of a result, just not getting beaten, I think we have enough depth and options to be solid and compact and get out of there with at least a draw.
I think you lean on your experienced players for situations like this, and that may be what Eileen's thinking, particularly in that first leg, just to make sure that you're compact between your back five and kind of your middle four, and try create those two banks where you're very difficult to break down. And maybe if experienced players are available, maybe that's what she leans on.
It's good to have Courtney back, isn't it? I know she didn't have a huge amount to do, but when she's not there, I guess it just feels not the same in ways, maybe because we've just got her, we've had her for so long in there.
Yeah, that's it exactly. It was unusual to see, you know, someone different. Grace, obviously Maloney was great at the same time to see her, you know, get a chance as well, even though it was a difficult game because she barely touched the ball. And same again last night. I think Courtney's first touch was after 20 minutes, and that even was with her feet. So, yeah, but it is good to have kind of a number one there and one that we can rely on now. I know early on in her career, she faced this slight bit of criticism just over she may have been prone to making mistakes or that, but now she's really, really developed into such a great goalkeeper, and I think she could prove vital. You know, she was vital in that playoff, getting to the World Cup too with a penalty save that not many, obviously Amber Barrett's goal stole the headlines, but she also saved Caroline Weir's penalty that night. So she has proven her worth over the last few years, and I think she'll be vital again, hopefully getting us to the Euros.
Yeah, she's such a solid presence and such a great character as well. There's a lot of competition now, Anthony, for places as well, which is brilliant. And look, we've had the same three centre halves for the last couple of games, but you know, seeing Niamh Fahey there on the bench as well, knowing the leadership qualities that she has, Louise Quinn as well, same thing. And you know, you throw in the world class players that we have in Katie and Denise, and things don't look too bad.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Diane Caldwell missed out as well with a back injury, an issue, against Georgia. So if you look, I mean, even a year ago, Marie, you were kind of looking at Louise Quinn and Niamh Fahey and Diane and the age they are now and where they are in their careers. And you were a little bit concerned about how Ireland would replace that trio. But now if you look, Caitlin Hayes and Anna Patton and Aoife Mannion, Jessie Staplin, as I said, is capable of operating in that part of the pitch. So lots of depth and lots of options. And you know, those older players, I mean, there was some speculation after the World Cup that some of those players might step away. I know Anya O'Gorman retired around that time, but actually none of the rest really have, and you can completely understand that, because why would they, you know, having come through such difficult times for so long with Ireland, why would you walk away now when we're on the cusp of another European chapter? So I'm sure they're all thinking of it, and they'll all be straining at the leash to make sure they're all fit and healthy for that two-legged playoff final against Wales, because that is going to be an immense occasion.
Yeah, and it's opportunity as well, Paul, isn't it? Because I think we've probably nearly got caught up in ways that, because we went to a World Cup, that we're there all the time, but we're not there all the time. Like, this is the thing. These are rare things in the players' careers as well that have worked so hard for it, but it's a huge opportunity to be on the big stage.
Yeah, huge opportunity. And particularly, you know, it's difficult to qualify for consecutive tournaments when you consider the group that we were drawn in. Initially it was so difficult to get out of that group, so we always knew that the likelihood is it would lie within a playoff situation. So we've done the easy work, I guess, of Georgia. It's now kind of the hard work of getting over the line against Wales. But I still think when you look at the squad and you look at the players and you look at the quality and combine that with the experience that we've had over the last 24 months, I think we should back ourselves that we are more than capable of getting past the Wales team and qualifying for another tournament. And that is where the growth of the game really takes place, both in the individuals who get to experience playing at the top level, but also then when you think of like the trickle down effect that has from participation to funding, just growing the game in all shapes and sizes. So it's really, really important. I think we have enough, Marie. We saw enough, I think, in those group stage games in particular. At the beginning, we probably looked a little bit raw when we were playing against top nation teams. I thought by the end of that group, when you think of the result that we had against France, I thought there seemed to be a huge amount of confidence amongst that squad of actually pitting themselves against top nation teams. And I think there'll be a huge confidence to get past Wales. And hopefully, if we qualify for the final tournaments, we're pitted in a group where we can compete and where we can get points, and I think we'll find ourselves in a better position than we were when we went down to Australia, just given the experiences that we've had. So it's a massive opportunity for the squad, for Eileen, for the women's game as a whole. And looking at it and considering that we're home in the second leg, I think we have enough to get over the line.
Maeve, I'd imagine as well, and you'll know, you'll be best placed to answer this, that the Ireland players will have very little fear of Wales. Okay, there was that game back in February, but I think we know now that they caught them on the hop a little bit. Ireland was trying the different formation. The team has changed quite a lot since then. But they'll know those players from playing against them along the way at different levels and the club scene and all the rest. And they will see them as very much opposition that are beatable.
Yeah, definitely. I think so. I mean, like that, they'll respect them, but at the same time, they won't fear them. And like you said, a lot of the girls will be familiar, even the likes of Kerry Holland, who scored the winner last night, would be Leanne and Nee's teammate at Liverpool. So yeah, there's a lot of familiarity between the squads, and we've played them plenty of times before. You know, even I remember way back, Denise's debut was away to Wales. She scored two in that game. So there's been a long history between the teams. And I think even you look at our history in trying to get to Euros as well, like, we've had a bit of a nightmare trying to qualify for the Euros way back in my time, 2008. We lost to Iceland on a frozen pitch over there, and of course we had the playoffs against Ukraine as well in 2020. So I think we're kind of trying to put those nightmares to bed a bit, and be really great to get over the line. I think really build on the success, because like the lads mentioned there, you know, getting to the first major tournament is great, but I think being able to build on it and qualifying for a second one in a row would really kind of change the landscape and really drive, I think, the game to a whole new level, just given the fact as well that it's obviously on in Switzerland, so there'll be a lot more interest around the game, a lot more fans will be able to travel over too. So
yeah,
hopefully the girls can get over the line.
It would actually be a great place for it to go on a summer holiday. And see, there was a great crowd there last night. Okay, it was sold out, it wasn't packed, but there was still over 8,000 people there, and it was a brilliant atmosphere. And everybody that I spoke to afterwards who came along, a couple of people had been their first game, they just really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it always is, Marie, isn't it? It's a great atmosphere at those games. There's something a little different when you compare it to the men's games, because I guess it's more family orientated and it's just really positive. And the thing is with this Ireland team, they win a lot more games than they lose. Like, I know they had a very tough qualification period in the Euros when they were up against France, Sweden and England, but generally speaking, it's a team that wins and has achieved things. And when you think of what Irish football has gone through in the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, it's been pretty bleak, and the shining light has been our Ireland women's team. They made the breakthrough to the World Cup. They have a great chance of making it to the Euros, and they're just great ambassadors as well, I think, for the country. Even the way they interact with the fans after the game, all of them, every single player knows the national anthem. They all sing it, and they sing it with gusto. It's almost like a ritual for any new players who come into the squad. They all have to learn it, and they do straight away. And all that sounds like a small thing. I'm not sure if it is, because it just sort of tells you maybe a little bit about the vibe behind the scenes as well. So yeah, it's really positive. And that game at the Aviva, that second leg, I mean, that is effectively, it's as close as you get to a cup final in international football. I think there'll be a massive crowd in the Aviva for that. It's a Tuesday evening, and it's going to be a huge occasion that we can all look forward to.
So, Maeve, hit us with it. How big a threat do Wales pose?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, they are obviously they're hoping to qualify as well. Like, that's one thing. They're not going to, you know, be rolled over. You know, they're really hoping to get through to it, and they have such experience. Like I already mentioned, you know, Jess Fishlock, she really does bring that leadership, and there's always talk about her retiring and stuff, but I think, you know, when she still has that ability on the pitch, then I can't see her retiring soon, to be honest. But even, you know, at the back they have Ladd and Evans, Roberts, they have just, I suppose, quality players throughout the team. And I think it's just It's going to be a difficult one. It's almost, you know, a bit like a derby, I suppose, in international football, just given they're so close to us. And I think they will pose a threat, but I think we should have enough. Like I said, they will have plenty of scouting done on them, and you know, all the background work will have been done by the backroom team. So there won't be any stone left unturned in that regard. So I think hopefully, you know, with the quality that we have, the depth we have now in all positions as well, I think we should be have enough in the tank, hopefully.
And Paul, from a player's perspective, the fact that they did have that disappointing outing against them in the very recent past, that's probably a good motivator.
Yeah, it is. And it's also, I guess, a warning to the squad that you don't take any shortcuts when it comes around to the Wales game. And one bad performance can absolutely kill you over two legs. And if you've a mountain to climb coming into the second leg, particularly in a playoff situation, it can be maybe too difficult to overcome. So I'd say that will be the message that Eileen will be delivering, is, you know, we got to be really professional. We got to prepare as if it's a France or an England or a Sweden, and give Wales that they absolutely deserve and respect. But at the same time, I think Eileen and the squad will be saying, well, we pay our respects, we have to make sure that we go out and express ourselves and we do what we know we are capable of doing. So it's a fantastic opportunity. I agree with Maeve. I think there's nothing there that we should overly fear. And I think there's enough quality, enough experience in that squad to navigate it over two legs and ensure that we get through.
Yeah, it'd be great, Anthony. Will we get through? I know you think we've enough, but it's going to be hard.
Yeah, it will be hard. It will be very close, but I think so. Yeah, I think we'll get through, Marie.
I'm looking forward to the build-up as well. And I think the fact that they're too tight, like they're going to be tight games, you know. It's like, it's nice. Here's me going, because we're getting excited because we've beaten Georgia, you know. I wanted a bit more of a challenge, but they're evenly met teams, and generally they provide, purely from a football fan perspective, they provide good games.
Yeah, well, I think there's parallels with the Scotland game a couple of years ago, and even in the rankings there was only about four or five places between Scotland and Ireland when they met in that playoff in Glasgow in 2022. That was settled by Amber Barrett's goal, but I mean the game swung. Like Courtney Brosnan made a great penalty save, I may have mentioned it earlier on. So that game could have gone either way. The reason I'm a little more confident about Ireland now is two reasons. I think the squad is deeper and better, and I think the fact that it's over two legs and the second leg is in Dublin, I think that's massive, and that's why I feel they'll do it.
It won't be over after the first leg. Definitely be something to play for.
Especially because when you see what happened with the Croatia or with the Slovakia game, so Slovakia were 1-2-1 in the first leg, and then Wales are the ones to come back and win it. So two really good games to come. Really looking forward to them. Maybe we'll talk to you again soon about all of that. We're turning our attention now to the other football, and that is the Carabao Cup, which is on tonight, and there's some really really intriguing ties, isn't there, when you look at the fixtures that are taking place tonight. You have Spurs Man City, Newcastle Chelsea, United Leicester, and has of course that that other layer of intrigue about Ruud van Nistelrooy taking that Man United team before Amaran comes in. Liverpool are playing Brighton as well, Aston Villa, Crystal Palace. Pick of the round, Paul Carey.
Pick of the round is probably, I was going to say Tottenham and City. I think Brighton and Liverpool will be a smashing game as well.
Yeah.
I think all four of those teams have enough strength and depth that even if they do rest a couple of players, there'll be a huge amount of quality on show. I'd probably lean on Tottenham and Man City purely on the basis that Ange Postecoglou is a type of manager who will not sit back irrespective of who he's playing against. He'll be all out attack. It'll be a really open game, and Man City will absolutely match them in that type of nature. So I'd say that will be a cracker of a game to watch.
Absolutely. I think though most people will be watching the Manchester United game because they want to see how Ruud van Nistelrooy gets on as a manager. It's going to be short-lived, but he gets to make an impact, Anthony Pine?
Well, I mean, he's going to go down very well, isn't he? He's a big fan favourite, and I'm sure the crowd will get right behind him. It's interesting because Amorim may have to, they may have to wait for on Amorim. He might have to serve a 30-day notice period with Sporting. So Van Nistelrooy might actually be in charge for up to six games, which is a pretty significant chunk of games when you think
You'll
about it.
You getting a bit of advice from John O'Shea.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But look, I guess the thing with him, when the difference, for example, to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, is that we all know that he's not going to get the job full time. This is very much an interim role for him. So as much as is possible at Man United at the minute, I guess he can enjoy it and maybe get a couple of wins if he can.
Okay, we're going to cross over to Portugal now to Tom Kundert from Portugal.net. Tom, lots of talk about the new Manchester United manager this side of the water. But for you guys with Ruben Amorim, what's the latest? And is it definitely a done deal?
Yeah, it's not definitely a done deal yet officially, but it really is all but official, because the key factor in all of this is the wishes of Ruben Amorim himself. And he's made it pretty crystal clear without actually saying it, spelling it out in these words, but he does want to be the next Manchester United coach. There's no doubt about that. And he wants to be it right now, by the looks of it. It was interesting. I just heard you speaking to your guest there about this possible 30-day period that Amorim would have to stay at Sporting for, because it's a very bad time for Sporting. You know, I think this is really what's got the backup of Sporting's, the board and even the fans. The fact that it's just come out of nowhere, really, and it seemed to be the expectation of Ruben Amorim and perhaps his coaching staff that, he said, OK, this once-in-a-lifetime chance has come. I want to leave. And you'll let me leave. And he thought it would just be like that. But, maybe because he's been such a roaring success at Sporting, he thought that the credit that had bought him would, kind of facilitate his exit. But Sporting are digging in their heels, okay, and they want him to stay.
That's made for a bit of an interesting saga, that's for sure. But look, if he does get over the line, which, as you said, it's all but a done deal, tell us about what has made him such a roaring success with Sporting.
Yeah, well, where do I start? You know, he's got so many strong points as a coach. It's really been a phenomenon. It's no exaggeration to say he's changed the face of Portuguese football in these last 5 years. He walked into a club, Sporting. I mean, if Manchester United think they're in a bad state now, you should look back at what state Sporting mm-hmm. were in when Ruben Amorim walked through the doors. They'd won the league. They hadn't won the league for 19 years. The 50 of their own fans had just about a year before he came into the club had invaded the training camp, attacked their own players, leading to a mass walkout. Lots of players rescinded their contract. Sporting went through four or five coaches the year before Amorim was hired. They were just a complete mess. And he just turned it round in incredibly quick fashion. His first full season, Sporting won the league. So like I say, after a 19-year gap. Second season, again, Sporting played very well, quite unlucky, finished second. Third season, not so good. Last season, won the league again, absolutely ran away with it. This season, if Amorim had stayed, they certainly would have won the league again. So he's just had a massive impact on Portuguese football, and he's really resurrected Sporting and turned what had become really the big two. Sporting mm-hmm. is known as the big three. Portugal is known for the big three, Benfica, Sporting and Porto, but it really had become the big two until Amorim came to Sporting and kind of restored Sporting's place among the elite and actually made them the best team in Portugal.
What's he like at managing players with big egos?
Very good, although it's a good question. It's a good question, because the calibre or the reputation of player that he'll deal with at Manchester United will obviously be, these kind of ready-made superstars will be... he hasn't really got experience of players who have this huge ego. He's made quite a few stars. He's developed players to become star names, but he hasn't really, when he came to mm-hmm. Sporting, they weren't full of star names. I suppose you can say the biggest star name he has is Victor Gyökeres now, who, of course, is on the tip of everyone's tongue, one of the most sought-after strikers in Europe. But they bought him for 20 million from Coventry City, who aren't even a Premier League team, are they? So, it's not quite the same as, trying to tell Bruno Fernandes and, all the rest of those guys what they should be doing. So, yeah, that's a fair mm-hmm. question, but he's such a good communicator that I, and he, you know, is so good at getting his message across to the players, and his results have just been so positive that they, the players buy into his philosophy. You know, that, that of course will be key, but I think they'll buy into it without any problems, to be honest.
Will he be a success?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've just talked a bit about his, you know, his results. I haven't even talked about the way he develops players. Mm-hmm. His kind of tactical nous is, you know, he's got so many strong suits. And yeah, I think he's just, he is, I think, the next phenomenon in terms of Portuguese coaching. A lot of people compare him to Mourinho. You know, that's obviously, I don't think you can go that far just yet. But I think he could, again, have a huge impact on English football.
Okay, look, it's it sounds very promising. Let's see how it plays out. Although I think I might have said that a few times in the past few years when new managers were appointed. But we'll see, Tom. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt. And he's brave. That's one thing he definitely is, because it's not an easy thing to step into that job. So much focus and intensity. And it makes or breaks a career. And it's hard to know what way it'll go. Tom Cundert of Portugal.net, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a very quick break. But do stay with us, because we'll be chatting Gaelic Games with Damien Lawler after these.
Game on 2FM.
Now we're turning our attention to Gaelic Games. I'm glad to say that Damien Lawler is with me on the line. Damien, how are you?
I'm good, Maureen. Good evening to you.
I love this time of year. County finals, brilliant stories. Yeah. Albeit I wasn't too happy when Sixmont Bridge didn't win their final on Monday, but still there's super storylines over the last weekend. Actually, it feels in particular this weekend was remarkable for the underdogs winning. Damien, what do you think?
Yeah, it was, like, and you know, you have All-Ireland finalists and All-Ireland champions gone as well, Marie. And I think, like, there's probably a huge focus this weekend just gone, maybe on the amount of teams that were being knocked out, and maybe the likes of even in your next door neighbours then in Doon winning Limerick. But mm-hmm. then if you look carefully, like, it's, you are beating big names along the way, like Newbridge beating Glen, you know, in the county final up in Derry, for example. But like, Newbridge have been impressive enough in the group stages this year. Got through their semi final, the game that we covered on RT2, and then won, I suppose, maybe a game that many people felt they wouldn't win. But you look at Doon then in Limerick. Doon came very close to beating the Pearsheik last year. So I think, like, you have to look back at the form lines, and the form lines have been there with the underdogs, but as you say, there's championship plots all over the country. Even here, we say, I was at the Kildare final last Sunday, and now next weekend you have James Burke and Brian Byrne get a chance to do a double. And again, Marie, in this day and age, they are quite rare to do a county senior double. Mm. And the footballers have just won 4 in a row, and the hurlers are going for 6 in a row. So, and then you're getting ready for your provincial campaigns, and nobody wants to stop now once you have a bit of silverware in the bag. So I think we've said it on this show for years. A lot of the real stories come out this time of year. It's the club player, it's the celebrations, the family connections are incredible, aren't they, Marie? They go back generations. And look, it's a good time, and I think, as I say, we'll be going through until late November with all provincial club games, and then you'll have the All-Ireland Club Camogie and stuff like that as well. So it doesn't ever stop anyway.
No, it really doesn't. One of the stories that I loved was about Newbridge and their defeat of Glen, and a guy called Robert, yeah, Roger Gribben put up a tweet, and it was a picture of an under 16B team, and he said 5 years ago today this bunch were beaten in an under 16B final. 7 started in the senior football on Sunday with another 4 on the bench. And for me, that's the story of the weekend, because you look at any underage team in a club, the aim, okay, grand, you can win your county titles along the way, but the aim is always to get the lads or the girls through to senior. And to see so many from a team that was playing under 16B, and just 5 years it took to get that many of them through, to me that shows what a brilliant environment, the work that's been done, the coaching, the belief, the community, and it's everything that the GAA is about.
Absolutely, and I'd say there's a fair stack of McGrogans involved in that. You know, the respective dads and uncles there have played a stalwart role over the last number of decades, and goes to show you too that the resilience of these young players, because to lose an underage county final is not simple, and you know, the fall off rate is quite alarming. from the ages of 12 to 18. Now, it's more prevalent for young girls falling off than young boys, but still there is a fall-off rate there, that you have to watch. And that goes back to the ethos then that you talk about. Maybe Nemo Rangers have been focused really on developmental and not mm-hmm. winning stuff at underage. And look at the silverware they've landed over senior yeah. level in the recent decades because of that ethos.
And Kerr fits a bit like that.
It's not easy to arrive on. A lot of coaches and a lot of people forget
yeah.
about the developmental side of things along the way, because winning probably becomes an unhealthy obsession for some coaches and some people in some parishes and some clubs. So I think no matter where you're pitched up, a long-term view and a long-term investment is what's needed, because, you know, your club can go all the way and win an All-Ireland title, but if the nursery isn't rocking there on mm-hmm. the weekends, and if the younger underage production lines aren't sending through 2 to 3 players every couple of years to that senior panel, well then you're in danger maybe of slipping down the rung of a ladder. And if you slip, it's not easy to halt that slide either. So, yeah, I think you're right, Marie. Strong underage development work, that's really the fulcrum of a club these days, I think. Anyway, the senior success, adult success, is like a cherry on the cake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just bringing the and keeping them in the game as well. It just shows how many of them stayed in the game too. So there was just brilliant stories all weekend, and we have to just talk about Doon. I can only just imagine what it's still like down there a few days on mm-hmm. because to win it for the first time, Damien, it's just amazing.
Well, look, I mean, we covered the game last year. I think they brought in a Piercy to extra time, and like they were so close to winning that in the Limerick semi-final last year. And I think you look at the players they have, you know, they've 3 or 4 county senior stalwarts. Pat Ryan, you know, I suppose in fairness to the midfield general, everybody keeps talking about him and what a player he's been for Limerick and for his club. And I suppose you look at the man of the match winner, and those three have been talked about in revered tones for a long time, Marie. But they also have, like Derek McGrath, you know, mm-hmm. wasn't going to take a coaching job this year. This year, but the Doon lads, I suppose, had got a hold of him and probably impressed him. And he probably saw the raw hunger that they had. And for that club, just maybe to bridge such a long gap and, like, probably get over the line. It's a huge thing for them. And I mean, I think Dermot was asked about the Ballygunner game after the final whistle, and it could have been the furthest thought from his own mind. And I know, like, my own club in Tipperary, we won after 37 years, and you're getting ready for a Munster Championship game the following weekend, and you must go out and represent your mm-hmm. club and county with pride. But like, those initial few days are just sheer celebration, I'd say. If there was a bank holiday in Ireland, but probably a bank holiday week in and around Doon, Marie.
Yeah, and look, you wouldn't begrudge them enjoying it either, because it's so hard to win anything.
The Piercy have been
In Clare, Feakle beat Sixmell Bridge, look, quite comprehensively as well, and they were in control for the whole of the game. But when you just look at the competitiveness of the championship down there, so they're the 11th different team to win the Senior Hurling Championship in 21 years. It's unbelievable, isn't it, to have so many clubs, such a spread. And actually, there was a lovely video, I'm sure you saw it during the summer, around one of the big games Clare played, where they released images, little short videos within a bigger video of the players and all the different clubs that are represented. It's such a rare thing, Damien, isn't it, to have so much competition in the county and to have so many players from different clubs.
Certainly, and look, I've noticed the spread in Clare over the last decade or so. Like, I mean, obviously when Lucknan's era was there, an awful lot of clubs were represented, but like then you probably during maybe the Dura Berryfield era, you're saying it's Ennis focused, but mm-hmm. not at all. Like, I mean, I think we've seen there, even with the rise of Feakle, like, I mean, you saw there maybe with Tulla with the Harty Cup as well, and the work that Terence Fahey did and bringing on, you know, players from surrounding clubs, and everybody bought into that. So that definitely was another step in the right direction. And if you look at Adam Hogan there, what he's won, and Adam Hogan will have hopefully have a good night on Friday night at the All-Stars, Marie, but you look at it there, like, with his club, with the school, with the county. like, he's only a young man. He's like literally ticked all the boxes there in the space of a year and a half, maybe, you know, since Tulla got the heart. He's been a non-stop upward curve for him. So, yeah, you're right. The spread of clubs who can win that championship is massive. It's a bit like the Tyrone Football Championship, and so many clubs fancy their chances of winning it. And again, you go back to the likes of the Ennis clubs and go back to the likes of Shane O'Donnell and Airoge, and you'd be expecting, you know, with the populations that are in and around there, that they'd be the dominant, the market leaders. But no, it's spread out through the countryside, it's spread out through the county. And look, again, Marie, I go back to Shane O'Donnell. He was in the news there the last day or so. But again, it could be a really good Friday night for Shane O'Donnell and Adam Hogan at the All-Stars on Friday. So we could be chatting about those two guys again next week, you know, for big awards.
Yeah, they've been so good. Let's talk about the inter-county scene then. Well, it looks like Clare are going to be sorted with the football, and Peter Keane, it looks like, is going to be appointed there. So there isn't too many left now looking for managers.
Yeah, so I think I am Peter Keane, like, you know, would have been in the mix for a couple of jobs there over the past year or so. I think Tipperary Football were hoping to get Peter on one stage. Derry Football, people met with Peter as well, which might seem bizarre considering the geographical distance, but look, it's changing times. But that didn't happen. But I think he's a massive, massive fit for Clare. I mean, Peter Keane, like the minor teams that he brought through along with other people in Kerry were absolutely, like, you know, All-Ireland winners there 5 years in a row. And Peter wouldn't have been involved in all of them, but he was involved in a fair chunk of them. And I think that people would argue he did not maybe get a fair crack at the whip in Kerry seniors, but this is a chance for him to get back on board. He'd be ratified at the next meeting, and it probably just leaves then Derry without a manager, Marie, because Stevie Poacher took the Leitrim job, as we predicted there last week. He took that Leitrim job. He had been working with St. Mochtins in Louth, got them to a semi-final, you know, played some good football, and I think he'll be a very organised, very structured coach. But look, he knows the game inside out, and the game is evolving, and we saw that with the FRC rules that are going to come in. So I think he's a good steady hand. He's been, you know, Turlough O'Brien's number two in Carlo. They achieved fine results, they put up great shows against the likes of Dublin, and I think anything that Stevie Poacher will put his mind to will be fairly organised. It'll be fairly committed. Everybody will know their jobs. He had a interesting last position he had inter-county was transition coach with Roscommon. He was there for a season under Anthony Cunningham, I think. So it'll be just interesting to see what he brings to that. Mickey Graham gone before him, and Andy Moran before that. So they've had three high profile names, and that just leaves Derry then, Marie, without a manager. And I guess that, you know, pre-season is gone, but the Challenge Match Circuit will be back soon enough too. GPA will be keeping a close eye on that too, because they want their 8-month inter-county season and no longer than that. So look, it's a different outlook for Derry. I think that 12 months ago there would have been a lot of people's favourites to go and win an All-Ireland title, and now they're without a manager, and it's a long way back for them at this point in time. So the next appointment is absolutely crucial for them. And you've heard names be mentioned over the past few months, from Mickey Moran to Seamus McEnany, and a plethora of names mentioned in between. But for one reason or other, the position is still vacant, and they're the last county standing now, Marie.
You hear names mentioned, all right, and then they're ruled out pretty quickly, or the person will go somewhere else. So, like, is there anyone even in contention, Damien, realistically?
Well, look, a number of names were in contention. Like, I mean, they did, like, there was, I think James Horne was in the mix for quite a while in terms of whether James would do it or not. I sincerely doubt it, because I don't think he'd manage anybody outside of Mayo, but I think there was big interest in him. There was big interest in Mark Doran, but Mark went off and, you know, got a position as coach with Roscommon, which is a massive, massive push on for them. And you hear other names, like maybe Peter's name being mentioned, but I don't know if much came of that. You heard Seamus McEnany's name being mentioned. You know, so it's been an ongoing issue since Mickey Hart stepped down and since Rory Gallagher vacated the seat before that. And I think that, you know, maybe at this stage, it's hard to know where they're going to go. I think when they looked at Mark Doran, they tried to appoint maybe a young upcoming coach who'd done doing a lot with Schlockneil and places like that. But I think whatever happened there, Marie, as you say, that fizzled out, and he went to Roscommon fairly soon afterwards. So I think with Christmas approaching, that's something that the county board will be keen to to get right and to get concluded as quickly as possible, because a new manager is coming in nearly behind the curveball already, and you want to get your plans and you want to get your ducks in a row and get everything sorted out for the new season. And particularly without pre-season, they're going to be depending on the challenge match circuit, you know, and to see... And the irony is that three or four young players have been blooded there on that side. Maybe a couple of years ago, they were accused of having the same 18 the whole time, but definitely three or four had influxed their way onto the team. So it's a very, very positive mix of youth and experience in that squad for any manager who takes over.
But it must be very frustrating for the players, Damien, because we know, okay, they mightn't be back training with the team, but they tend to not take too much time off from a general fitness and sharpness perspective.
No.
So just even if it's going to the gym, getting on a programme, working towards something, it must be very difficult for them, kind of being in limbo.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the best they can manage at the moment is working to previous S&C regimes. I'm sure they'll all have good, their clubs will have good S&C people there helping them out. But yeah, definitely the lack of uncertainty at this stage has to be a concern for them. And the senior players then will know that they are still within touching distance, because they've won Munsters and they've won a National League title in the past 3 years. So they're not far off the mark, but you know, you must have everything right. And the sooner you can get your structures laid down, well, then you can build your foundation on top of that. So look, I think nobody up there needs reminding, but is it very messy? It's definitely prolonged, and it's helping nobody. Players be very frustrated at this. I think all concerned will be glad when an appointment is made. And I keep hearing Mickey Moran's name mentioned as a kind of a father figure in the background, but they're going to need somebody to come along with dynamic thoughts as well to ally to Mickey's experience, you know.
Absolutely. And as you said, there's no pre-season to be trialling the are figuring out rules, yeah.
No pre-season, Marie, and I think the latest news I have then is that county boards have been contacted by the FRC, the Football Review Committee, that they'll all be in consultation again ahead of Special Congress, because if all these new football rules come into play, well then this was the year to have your pre-season. But as we know now, they're not coming back. So I think the FRC are keen to just confirm and underline, clarify exactly what's going through and exactly what the process will be. So as I say, if you were Derry, you know, you want your manager in place for meetings like that as well.
Yeah, for sure. Damien, thank you for all of that. And we'll be talking to you again next week.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. An independent economic report was published this morning, and it tells us that the League of Ireland contributes 164.7 million annually to the Irish economy through direct activities. I'm delighted to say that we are joined on the line now by the League of Ireland Director, Mark Scanlon. Mark, you're so very welcome. Tell us a little bit about this report, what's in it, and the benefits to the economy that League of Ireland football brings.
Hi, Marie. Thanks for having us on. Yeah, we're very excited about the release of the first ever economic impact assessment on the League of Ireland. And as you mentioned, a significant figure for contribution to the economy with 164.7 million. So the report itself details all of the club's annual accounts from the 2023 season, has a look at the attendances across the league, TV viewership, and then shows both the direct and indirect impact on the economy of the league. So significant report, which shows again how much the league contributes towards the economy and how important our clubs are to their local communities.
Yeah, it really is. And there's good detail in it. Just even, I guess, things I probably wouldn't have thought about too much, but the number of staff even that are employed by League of Ireland directly, the clubs, full and part-time, over 1,600. That's quite significant, Mark.
Yeah, I think it's a surprise to people really to see the amount of employees that are there across, obviously significantly the players being the biggest number within that, but also the growing number of coaching staff across the clubs, especially as the academy levels continue to grow as well, and then into the rest of the full-time equivalent employees and areas like match officials and staff working within the League of Ireland department within the FAI as well. So a significant number of people that are directly engaged, and then also a much larger number of full-time equivalents supported indirectly through the activity of the league as well. And we can see that increasingly, particularly on Friday nights when we see sold-out stadiums across the country, and we see the impact on the local communities when the pubs and the restaurants are thriving with the supporters going to games.
It must be really heartening, because when you see the numbers, and also knowing as well that it's such an area for growth, the potential must be huge, Mark.
Yeah, I think that's really what the report highlights. I think sometimes we'll see growth in maybe one particular area, but in this report you can see growth across all areas. So the attendance is one has been well documented already. You can see the 78% increase in attendances at league games since 2019. But also when you see the growing number of TV viewership, the numbers across streaming within LOI TV as well, a significant rise of our audiences across digital media and social media as well. So all of the areas and all of the metrics are really positive, and the league is certainly heading in the right direction, and hopefully it's something that by the time the next report is commissioned that we can see an even much bigger impact on the league. But it requires obviously investment at that level, and what we want to see over the next few years is continued investment into the infrastructure and into the academies, and hopefully the league will continue to contribute towards the local and national economies.
What do you see when you read this and you take into account everything, and of course all that you've learned in the role and what you know from being around football for so long, what are the biggest challenges do you think that will maybe limit the potential for growth?
Well, I think it's no doubt that the infrastructure has been well documented in the past, certainly in terms of the attendances. You look at the amount of sold-out signs we've had across the league. There's definitely a need for increased attendances, increased capacity in our stadium. So some of the best examples we have, if you look at the cup final last year and you see 43,881 people attend the cup final, and then the opening day of the season, we can't fit that amount of people into 10 League of Ireland grounds. So that shows you that we absolutely need increased capacity in the stadiums. We're very thankful this year for the increase in the sports capital grants from government, and hopefully over the next coming days or weeks we'll see some good news around the large scale sports infrastructure fund. And it's really important that the stadiums continue to grow. But then secondly, it's that whole area around academies again, which we've spoken about consistently over the last period of time, where we hope to see an increased level of investment into the academy so that they can continue to thrive. We can continue to develop players for both the League of Ireland clubs and for the national teams. And then hopefully from there, the whole economy of professional football will continue to develop.
The title race must be helping as well, Mark.
Yeah, the title race has been brilliant. It's been a very exciting year. We've had a few exciting years in the SSE or Tristy Women's Premier Division where we've gone down to the wire. So it's nice to also have that in the Men's Premier Division this year. An exciting night ahead on Friday.
Yeah, for sure. Mark Scanlon, thank you so much for joining us. That is all we have time for this evening. The new music show with Bella De Silva is up next.
RTE 2FM.